In our first meeting, I attempted to introduce a path by which we might approach C.G. Jung and his mysterious big book, the Red Book. Most of us in this room have a personal engagement with the field of psychology, at least in its broadest definitions. I suspect many of us here have had some experience with the reality of intrapsychic forces and their ability to disrupt our lives and perhaps even sometimes heal our lives. To wound us and to heal us. Perhaps we have been patients, wounded. The experience of being a patient in dynamic psychology is a critical part of the educational process for those working in clinical fields, in the clinical field of psychology. It is a critically important part, and indeed it may be dangerous for us to ever stop being a patient, at least a patient to our own conscious consideration. We all sometimes need the good counsel of ourselves, and that can be a very hard thing to find. In these seminars, I felt strongly that I wanted to engage you as clinicians, whether you actually be a clinician or not. In this room among you, there are decades of experience, in some cases clinical, psychological experience. You come with a past. And amongst the things you come with is something even more important. Something uniquely personal. The most important clinical experience any of you will have, any of you do now have, comes through meeting your own psyche, your own soul. This is part of the mystery of the psyche. It is the most subjective of all empirical studies. We only experience one psyche, one soul, directly, and in complete intimacy. Whose? Whose? Our own. Our own. Our experience of that psyche molds the patterns and all presumptions about the realm of psychic experience. We all have basic presumptions, born of our personal experience, our education, our clinical encounters as patients, as therapists, as people engaged in a consideration of our own soul. We have ideas about the wounds of the soul and the healing. And we all have basic presumptions. They're born of our personal experience and our education and our clinical encounters. You know, I suppose there may be even a few people present or in hearing of these words that question the use of the word soul, with all of its historical incrustations of meanings, and perhaps find the word totally irrelevant to modern science, to our modern worldviews. If that view is present, I have no argument to make. I allow it, but I have to say, I don't agree with it. In my experience, I do not agree with that theory. I have experienced life differently. What Jung asks us in meeting Liber Novus, what I'm asking of you, is something really difficult. For many people, it may be completely impossible. In confronting Liber Novus, Jung is petitioning us to place aside our presumptions, the presumptions engendered by the spirit of this modern time, presumptions that may be our own. He is asking us to join him in a journey across the threshold of consciousness, past the modern gatekeepers of intellectual propriety, use, and value. He asks that we share with him a journey into a primordial, forgotten depth, the depths of the human soul, the forgotten half of the human fact. To appreciate what happened to Jung, it is critically important to hear him out. Hear him out as you would the most interesting patient you have met or would ever hope to meet. And in doing that, remember that the patient is the teacher. So meet him as a patient. Examine him in detail. Take a clinical history. Weigh this story against everything you know or might hope to know about human experience of the psyche. That's quite a challenge. In my own opinion, Jung's experience recorded in Liber Novus stands completely outside the bounds of common experience. And Jung knew that. Those who come to his new book, the Red Book, Liber Novus, embracing... Somebody at the door there. I was. Oh my gosh. It's real too. So those who come to Liber Novus, embracing a pedestrian consciousness and intellectual curiosity, constrained predominantly by the materialistic spirit of this time, are probably going to leave the book completely befuddled. But whatever struggle one encounters in understanding Jung, keep in mind that what the man did was one of the most important events of his life. Keep in mind what he said about his experience, recorded in Liber Novus. And I quote, these are his words from the end of his life. "My entire life consisted in elaborating what had burst forth from the unconscious and flooded me like an enigmatic stream and threatened to break me." My entire life consisted in elaborating. Everything later was merely the outer classification, the scientific elaboration, and the integration into life. But the numinous beginning, which contained everything, was then. End quote. Jung's story, the clinical history of this period in his life, is crucial if one will understand the empirical basis of Jung's psychology and his approach to the psyche. Jung's statement above makes it very clear that despite the vast clinical experience Jung accumulated over 6 decades as a doctor, the clinical encounter of signal importance was his own encounter with his own interior reality, his own psyche, the numinous beginning, which contained everything, was then. You know, I talked in our first session about the importance of clinical history. History, history, history. I was pointing in this instance to a specific case history. I'm attempting to suggest that Jung's experience was paradigmatic. If we understand this paradigmatic case, that understanding may open a new era in our own understanding of and our own relationship to the psyche, to our own interior reality. You know, the case history is has a long provenance in the lore of the physician. It remains for the physician a central focus and tool of clinical pedagogy. In all the clinical teaching I've done over the last 30 years, the history and the exam of one patient, one specific patient, are the primary foundation from which I necessarily work as a teacher, as a clinician, as a clinical teacher. Indeed, one richly becomes a physician when one leaves the classroom of science and theory and begins to focus on clinical interactions with real people. That is true of all the healing arts. The validity or relevance of any theoretical concept or physiological fact heard in class or read in a book must be focused against the spectrum of human experience. And that education starts anew with each patient, with each of our human relationships. The patient is the teacher. We learn from human experience the art of healing, not from disembodied theories. As we meet patients, humans, one by one, we enter deeper and deeper into an understanding of the manifold complexity of human life and of human suffering. Though every human experience is unique, some clinical histories do seem paradigmatic. They are general examples, models of understanding. Pedagogically, they can open our perception, our understanding, our perspective upon a disease, a category of pathology, a type of woundedness that manifests in human life. The paradigmatic case helps us understand a type of suffering. Through carefully listening to the story of one specific patient, we may learn lessons that guide us through an entire lifetime. Every clinician I know has a memory of one such patient. In our first session, I told you about one of mine. But on occasion, a case comes along where the clinical history, what we hear, doesn't fit any paradigm we know. It doesn't fit anything we've met before or have been told about in the pedagogical experience, the learning experience of our training. And one is left scratching her head. You know, it's almost axiomatic that anything that has ever happened to a human mind and body, a brain and its matter, has probably happened sometime before. Hmm? So when we meet that thing that doesn't fit our patterns, our understood categories, well, sometimes we have an obligation to go looking at the clinical annals, to go looking at history, trying to find that example. And this has happened to me several times, and nowadays it's quite easy to do a Medline search, to go looking for things, you know, that meet certain clinical parameters. But some things are a bit more diffuse. Some things don't give you such easy clues. Sometimes you really are left scratching your head. The case has unique qualities that confound our categorization. It is an outlier, an oddity. At this point, one can just shrug and mutter, it doesn't make sense. Or perhaps refer this multi-angular peg to another clinician who is more willing to shove it into a misfitted categorical hole. That's the easy path. Don't do that. Don't do that with Jung and his Red Book. Don't take that path in your consideration of Carl Jung, his story, his history. What Jung experienced was rare. It is so rare that you probably possess no paradigm that will fit it. And yes, the experience was rare. But the record Jung made of his experience, the way he approached his experience, the way he attempted for an entire lifetime to integrate an understanding of his experience into the healing arts, his hermeneutic of the experience, his exegesis of the experience, that really, I believe, is entirely unprecedented in the annals of clinical medicine. Rare facts require rare degrees of attention. Don't push them into ill-fitting categorical holes. This is a rare case. And yet, in it, you may find a paradigm that helps you see anew. Jung and his Liber Novus, the Red Book, may provide you a new paradigm for understanding the mystery of the human soul. Last session, we left Dr. C.G. Jung on the threshold of vision. After 13 years as a physician struggling to understand the mystery of the human soul, the man found himself without a theory adequate to the breadth of his observations. As a young doctor, he had embraced the scientific methods of his day, and he had helped establish and propagate a new form of medical practice, psychoanalysis. And here, note well, this was a medical specialty. Its early practitioners were principally physicians who saw themselves as opening a new realm of medical science. They were focused on understanding and healing a type of human wound or pathology or disease. These founding physicians, including Jung, considered their analytical interactions with patients as standing entirely within the tradition of the physician and his or her healing arts, For about 5 years, starting around age 32, Jung had closely allied himself with Sigmund Freud. But by the time he had reached his 35th year, around 1910, he found his own observations could no longer fit into the confines of Freud's sexual theory, his sexual dogma, or anyone's theory, for that matter, including any theory he himself had contrived. There was no coherent theory, no system, no concept, no paradigm, yet part of medical science that adequately explained his observations. And principal among all his observations was, of course, his observation of himself. The single psyche he knew intimately. The single psyche he empirically experienced completely and directly. His own life in his early years had revealed to him a depth in that psyche that would not fit the confinement of current biological and materialistic science. In Memories, Dreams, Reflections, Jung's autobiographical memoir, which I'll subsequently probably refer to simply as Memories. In Memories, you have read about those experiences. And if you haven't, read them. And I should add, these early memories, the first chapters of Memories, Dreams, Reflections, were written by Jung himself, in his hand. He, as his interview process with Anya Liafe went along, he started feeling a need to not just talk with her, but write a few things. And he sat down and wrote his earliest memories up to about age 19, those first chapters of Memory, Dreams, Reflections. And he addressed the manuscript to my children. It was a very private thing that he wanted to hand on to them. That introduction to my children was, of course, edited out of the text as we have it in Memories, Dreams, Reflections. So, to summarize a few of those early life experiences, his mother and several ancestors had intense visionary experiences, of which he had heard direct testimony. Around age 12, he had had his own rather remarkable vision of a turd falling from the throne of God and shattering the Basel Cathedral. Memorable event. Certainly memorable to dear Carl Gustav Jung. And in his adolescent years, there were these strange paranormal events in his household, which he had witnessed. The kitchen table cracking suddenly. A well-made quality steel knife exploding in the drawer. I should add to you that that knife that exploded in the drawer, he kept that knife in a little box on his desk until his dying day. It sat right in front of him in that box on his office desk all of his life. I've seen pictures of it. It may be there now still because Andreas Jung, who's Jung's grandson, now takes care of the home, following in the footsteps of his father, Franz, Jung's son. And they've kept a lot of these things, particularly Jung's office, as they were. And then there were those amazing seances with his cousin, Helena Preisbuch, conducted during his medical school years, beginning around the time Jung was about age 20. And there is yet another experience during these years, between 1905 and about 1910, that I will mention. An extraordinary patient, a woman patient that he dealt with, who had an amazing mythology of love, salvific, transformative love. And if we get there, that's what we're going to talk about in the second half of tonight. Okay, now he's 38. It's 1913. This man had treated hundreds of psychotic patients, heard their stories, witnessed the intimate details of their lives and the fragmentation of those lives. And in October of 1913, he had been twice overcome by open visions of destruction, visual hallucinations. By any theory, he knew he was himself potentially on the verge of psychosis, madness, schizophrenia. He described the events in a letter to the famous mythologist Mircea Eliade. I think the letter was written around 1948. And it contains some details different than you find in Memories, Dreams, Reflections. So let me just read that account. In October 1913, while traveling by train from Zurich to Schaffhausen, and Schaffhausen was where his mother-in-law lived, so he was probably on the way to visit her. While traveling by train from Zurich to Schaffhausen, a strange incident befell me. Passing through a tunnel, I lost consciousness of time and place and was awakened an hour later when the conductor announced the arrival at Schaffhausen. During all this time, I was the victim of an hallucination, a waking dream. I was looking at the map of Europe and saw how country by country, beginning with France and Germany, all Europe became submerged under a sea. Shortly afterwards, the entire continent was underwater, with the exception of Switzerland. Switzerland was like a high mountain that the waves could not submerge. I saw myself seated on the mountain. But then, on looking more closely around me, I realized the sea was blood. Floating on the waves were corpses, rooftops, charred beams. End quote. Jung had arrived at the crossroads of his life. The crossroads. The place of Hermes. Something was attempting to overpower him, pull him perhaps into insanity, perhaps as it had Friedrich Nietzsche and others. Jung had no theory, no method to staunch this wound. The prognosis appeared grave. His only option was to meet this fact, to investigate further, to understand the psyche. And to understand, he needed to go in. He had to explore the wound. Know the wound. He needed to submit to experience its depth and power and voice and nonsense and madness. But he knew, he realized, he needed to bring to this task all his conscious analytic ability. It would be an experiment, his most dangerous experiment, indeed a very dangerous experiment. He would keep a clinical record, and he would give every detail of this case, the case of this patient, his utmost attempt at understanding. He would give his own psyche the attention of a physician, of his own consciousness. The task he had attempted with many patients before. And so begins the Red Book. He speaks in Liber Novus, and I quote, "When I had the vision of the flood in October of 1913, It happened at a time that was significant for me as a man. At that time, in the 40th year of my life, I had achieved everything that I had wished for myself. I had achieved honor, power, wealth, knowledge, and every human happiness. Then my desire for increase of these trappings ceased. The desire ebbed from me, and horror came over me. The vision of the flood seized me, and I felt the spirit of the depths. The spirit of the depths. I felt the spirit of the depths. But I did not understand him. Yet he drove me on with unbearable longing. And I said, "My soul, my soul, where are you? Do you hear me? I speak. I call. Are you there? I have returned. I am here again. I have shaken the dust of all the lands from my feet. I have come to you. I am with you." After long years of long wandering, I have come to you again. My soul, where are you? Those words are the primal ground of Jung's psychology. They are a key to understanding. They are a key to understanding everything that follows. Okay, you guys have the red book. Let me talk a little bit about the structure of the book, because as people come to it, it's a bit confusing, to say the least. But let me explain a little bit about the structure of the book, and this will help you understand the layers of commentary, the way the voices of expression change in the book. When Jung started this experiment, he determined he would keep a clinical record. And he did that, as I mentioned in our last session, in a series of small journals, black books. I've seen two of them. And they're about this big. They're simple school notebooks. The first two have sort of brown covers, and all the rest of them, the last several, have black covers. There was one book he had from earlier years, and then there are six of these black books that he devoted to the process, the things that he went through from 1913 through about the mid-1920s. And he kept a detailed record. These books do not have dreams in them. These books have his visions, the things that he saw that happened to him. They're dated, and they proceed chronologically, page by page, event by event. After he had composed these books, or at least not all of them, but after these events had moved on through the first year or so, he decided that something had happened that needed a more formal, a more precious record. At that point, he took, and this was about 1915. So these events really broke loose, as you'll read in Memories, Dreams, Reflections, from 1913 through the summer of 1914, the first part of this. And then, in August of 1914, World War I broke out. At that point, Jung understood that some of this stuff that was coming through him, that the vision of blood encompassing all of Europe, it was not just him. Well, not just him. It was him. He had seen it. But he sensed that something was going on, that there were forces at play in his world that were forces at play in his psyche, that there was some sympathy, some synchronicity. And it became apparent to them that the visions he had 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 more than just personal meaning. He says, "At this point, my life ceased to belong to me alone." He felt that this experience he had was indeed paradigmatic, epical, and it needed to be recorded. So he typed out a manuscript draft. Well, first he wrote a manuscript draft, and then that was typed out for him. This is around 1915. When he did the manuscript draft, which is about 1,200 pages, he added a second layer. He had the initial visions as he recorded them in his journals at the time they happened. And then in this period where he started doing the draft, compiling them, which happened between 9 months and a year after the visions themselves, he added a second commentary layer. Now, that second commentary layer is not distantly removed from the events. He's still very much in the affect and memory of what had happened. But he's trying to bring a first level of consciousness to the events. And so when you read the Red Book, the editors have noted these two layers. As you read the Red Book, you'll see that section by section, title head by title head, there will be two parts. The first part is labeled 1. This section is pretty much a direct transcription of Jung's black books. And Sonu, Dr. Shandasamy, who did the editing, went through very carefully and looked at this. These have very few removals or additions from the text as it appears in his journal. And then comes a second section, and that'll be started with a 2. Section 2. That section is the material that Jung added 9 months to 12 months later, meditating specifically upon those events, that portion. Okay. Those comments do not appear in his journal. They were added as he considered the journal event. That's important as you go through because you will see the voice changes. First, there's this primary event, and then there's a reflection on the event. And the reflection comes later, 9 months to a year or a bit more later. When he makes the reflection, he's gone through a whole series of this stuff. He started to gain a perspective. But in the initial vision, the part 1, he's just there. This is flowing forward quickly. And over what period of time are we talking about? Months. This stuff broke loose in November 1913. The Red Book, the first two sections, Liber Primus and Liber Secundus, of the first and second part of what is called Liber Novus, the Red Book, really only goes through April of the next year. November, December, January, February, March, April. One hell of a winter. That's what he did. But then you see, after he started doing his transcription of these events, it all broke loose again. In 1915, after he'd finished his draft, the visions started coming again. But they came in a different form, more intensely focused, more reflected, and in some ways deeper. Those events form the last part of the third section of Liber Novus that Jung called the scrutinies. Okay. At the very beginning of Liber Novus, the new book. And maybe I should add, for those who weren't here the first time, why is it called Liber Novus? Because that's the title Jung put on the cover. It was always referred to as the Red Book by people who knew him or who had seen it, because it is a rather large, as you may know, red book. The original has 600 pages, and it weighs quite a bit. But the title is actually Liber Novus, the new book. That's the title Jung gave it. So after he had done this draft material, after he had written the draft by hand, after he had done the typescript, then, at that point, Jung added in a prologue, a prome, a beginning. It's really a reflection upon the whole. And those first words, those first 2 pages or so of the Red Book that you'll encounter are written, not at the beginning. They're written at the end of this process as he reflects back upon what happened to him. Let me just read that prologue, because this is essential. This is Jung's reflection on what had happened to him. And there are some points in here, some things he says in here, that you simply have to hear and hear again as you reflect upon this book. This is his reflection upon it. Written in 1915. If I speak in the spirit of this time, I must say, no one, and nothing can justify what I must proclaim to you. Justification is superfluous to me, since I have no choice, but I must. I have learned that in addition to the spirit of this time, there is still another spirit at work, namely that which rules the depths of everything contemporary. The spirit of this time would like to hear of use and value. I also thought this way, and my humanity still thinks this way. But that other spirit forced me nevertheless to speak beyond justification, use, and meaning. Filled with human pride, and blinded by the presumptuous spirit of the times, I long sought to hold that other spirit away from me. But I did not consider that the spirit of the depths, from time immemorial, and for all future, possesses a greater power than the spirit of this time, who changes with the generations. The spirit of the depths has subjugated all pride and arrogance to the power of judgment. He took away my belief in science. He robbed me of the joy of explaining and ordering things. And he let devotion to the ideals of this time die out in me. He forced me down to the last and simplest things. The spirit of the depths took my understanding and all my knowledge and placed them at the service of the inexplicable and paradoxical. He robbed me of speech and writing for everything that was not in his service, namely, the melting together of sense and nonsense, which produces the supreme meaning. The spirit of this time whispered to me, this supreme meaning, this image of God, this melting together of hot and cold, that is you, and only you. But the spirit of the depths spoke to me, you are an image of the unending world. All the last mysteries of becoming and passing away live in you. If you did not possess all of this, how would you know? For the sake of my human weakness, the spirit of the depths gave me this word. Yet this word is also superfluous, since I do not speak it freely. But because I must. I speak because the spirit robs me of joy and life if I do not speak. I am the serf who brings it and does not know what he carries in his hand. It would burn his hands if he did not place it where the master orders he lay it. The spirit of the time spoke to me and said, what dire urgency could force you to speak all this? This was an awful temptation. I wanted to ponder what inner and outer bind could force me into this. And because I found nothing that I could grasp, I was near to making one up. But with this, the spirit of our times had almost brought it about that instead of speaking, I was thinking again about reasons and explanations. But the spirit of the depths spoke to me and said, "To understand a thing is a bridge and possibility of returning to the path. To explain a matter is arbitrary and sometimes even murder." Have you counted the murderers among the scholars? But the spirit of this time stepped up to me and laid before me huge volumes, which contained all my knowledge. Their pages were made of ore, and a steel stylus had engraved inexorable words in them. And he pointed to these inexorable words and spoke to me and said, "What you speak is madness." It is true. It is true. What I speak is the greatness and intoxication and ugliness of madness. After this, my humanity remained silent. Something happened to my spirit, however, which I must call mercy. My speech is imperfect, not because I want to shine with words, but out of the impossibility of finding those words. I speak in images. With nothing else can I express the words from the depths. The mercy which happened to me gave me belief, hope, and sufficient daring not to resist further the spirit of the depths, but to utter his word. But before I could pull myself together to really do it, I needed a visible sign that would show me that the spirit of the depths in me was at the same time the ruler of the depths of world affairs. End quote. The prologue of Liber Novus. The next sentence is, and it happened in 1913. Or excuse me, it happened in October of 1913. And he talked about the visions. So he says, I needed a visible sign that showed me that the spirit of the depths in me was at the same time the ruler of the depths of world affairs. What was that? It was the eruption of the war in 1914. All these visions in the first parts of Liber Novus had happened before the outbreak of that war. He had had repeated visions that seemed to indicate the coming of this sort of destruction. And when it happened, it gave him that sign. Now, that's not to say that his visions were prophetic looks into the future. And the fact that he could see the future was somehow allowed him to speak. It's the sense that the inner and the outer realms, what he was experiencing so intensely inside, actually was also part of his world. That there was a connection. He felt a connection between the inner and the outer. Okay, spirit of this time. What is that? Ideas? Spirit of this time. What's Jung talking about? Go for it.
Personal history and how that connected to his world, his external number one personality.
His number one personality?
That he talks about in his dreams and reflections. Okay. Kind of the more intellectual, extroverted parts of his life, pursuing science.
What world do we think we live in?
That first one.
The time. Okay. He's talking about the world we think we live in. The world as we experience it outwardly. But more. Okay, the ego of the world and the shadow of the world. And perhaps maybe the spirit of the depths has something apart from that, maybe something even deeper. But the ego of the world, that's a way of thinking about it. The ego. The I. But there's more. Presumptions. Paradigms. Does the spirit of the time have a paradigm? Paradigms? A set of paradigms?
Hundreds,
right, hundreds. Hundreds and hundreds. Is there a predominant viewpoint that characterizes certain ages? Yes? No?
No, there are several.
There are multiple. But are there defining paradigms? Particular viewpoints that characterize an age. In other words, are there viewpoints in our age today that would be quite foreign or quite different than the viewpoints, say, of the Middle Ages? Is there something there that's different? Huh?
Yes, I think that's accurate.
Okay.
Science and religion, all of those systems, essentially.
Okay. You know, he didn't define what he meant by the spirit of the times, did he? He talked about an experience that he defined. He's talking about, I think, a perspective towards his age. Positivistic, materialistic, scientific viewpoint.
Soulless.
So then, in contradistinction, what's this spirit of the depths that Jung is experiencing? That's a term. That's a term he used subsequently to define and experience. But it's not he wasn't dealing with a theoretical thing. He was dealing with a voice, with a power that he could only name with the spirit of the depths. In this spirit of the times, is there polarity? Is there a difference between the spirit of the times and the spirit of the depths? You see, Jung was perceiving that in his time, or experiencing, better stated, that there was some inner reality which he was directly experiencing, which was not being adequately approached. Not being approached at all. In fact, apparently discarded, forgotten, and denied. Whether he was right or wrong, philosophically speaking, it was his experience. He said the supreme meaning was the melding of sense and non-sense. Sense and non-sense. Does anyone have a perspective on what that means? The supreme meaning. Melding of sense and nonsense.
The spirit of the depths wouldn't be understood by
the spirit of the times, essentially. Couldn't know it with scientific method.
Yeah. Sense and nonsense. Sense and nonsensical. Non-rational. Non-rational, perhaps?
Or maybe it's just more literal, not sensory, not thought, not mental.
But experiential? Okay. That's a way of seeing it. We'll come back to that one. That's really a key. Because he says it involves the supreme meaning. And we all do want to know the supreme meaning, don't we? Explaining his core perception, maybe this might help. This comes later in the Red Book. And I quote from the Red Book. This is really a key description of what Jung was experiencing. Quote, "If you remain within the arbitrary and artificially created boundaries, you will walk as between two high walls. You do not see the immensity of the world. But if you break down the walls that confine your view, then the ancient sleeper awakens in you. Then, in the whirl of chaos, dwells eternal wonder. Your world begins to become wonderful. Man belongs not only to an ordered world, he also belongs to the wonder world of the soul. If you look outside yourselves, you see the far-off forest and mountains, and above them your vision climbs to the realm of the stars. And if you look into yourselves, you will see, on the other hand, the nearby as far off and infinite. Since the world of the inner is as infinite as the world of the outer. Just as you become part of the manifold essence of the world through your bodies, so you become part of the manifold essence of the inner world through your souls. This inner world is truly infinite, in no way poor, in no way poorer than the outer. Man lives in two worlds. Woman lives in two worlds." Sometimes it seems they're not the same one. You know, as this is an image that came to me when I was thinking about these things a while ago, of the unconscious. You know, when people are coming to the threshold of a real encounter with their inner selves, with the unconscious, and often this is sort of something that happens in the middle of our lives, there's a type of dream that I've heard several times that many people have noted is quite common. And it's the dream of diving into water, of going underwater. You know, often I think that the metaphor of the unconsciousness in that image of entering in deeply under the surface of something, into a substance. But I realized that there was a problem with the metaphor in terms of Jung's psychology. Because you see, the ocean has a floor. There's a bottom. That's how we see the psyche, isn't it? You know? Are unconscious. It's a glass. It may be a really tall glass, but there's a bottom. It's sort of like we can dive in and get to the bottom. Jung is saying that inner world is truly infinite. No bottom. That fractures something in the spirit of our time. It fractures it. That we are a doorway. That we have an eye. That we see out and see infinity. But if we knew to look in, you will see, on the other hand, the nearby, very nearby, that the nearby is as infinite as the world of the outer. Sounds sort of mystical, doesn't it? It is an experience people have. The metaphor of the unconscious should never be enclosed with a bottle. So a journey had begun. But for Jung, the course that journey would take was obscure. He simply had to let things happen. Let the unconscious find its voice. How else could he hear its intent? See its point of view or probe its depths. Two nights later, on 14 November of 1913. And again, remember, these comments are dated. They're in the journals. These journals are in a safe in Zurich, and I've seen a couple of them. They had them on display in the museum shows surrounding the Red Book that have traveled to several cities of the world. Two nights later, on 14 November 1913, he called out to his soul. I am weary, my soul. My wanderings have lasted long, my search for myself outside myself. Now I have gone through events, humanity, and the world. I found men. And you, my soul, I found again. First in images within men, and then you yourself. I found you where I least expected you. You climbed out of a dark shaft. I wandered for many years, so long that I forgot I possessed a soul. I belonged to men and things. I did not belong to myself. Where were you all this time? Which beyond sheltered you and gave you sanctuary? How should I decipher you? Who are you, child? My dreams have represented you as a child, as a maiden. And I found you again only through the soul of the woman. I am ignorant of your mystery. Look, I bear a wound that is not yet healed. My ambition to make an impression. Forgive me if I speak in a dream, like a drunkard. Are you God? Is God a child? A maiden? How strange it sounds to me to call you a child. You who hold the all without end in your hand. End quote. There's a phrase here that I read that appears only in Jung's Black Book journal. He didn't transcribe it into the calligraphic copy of the Red Book. He said, my dreams have represented you as a child and as a maiden. And I found, this is the part that's only in the Black Book, and I found you again only through the soul of the woman. We'll come back to those words later.
I can't quite hear the last couple of verses. You say, only through the soul of...
The woman. I found you only through the soul of the woman. Now, Jung had started a journey. He didn't know where it was going. He didn't know what was going to come next. He had no paradigm of what he was doing. He felt that he had to contact some inner reality. These first sections of the Red Book recount that story. He felt he was wandering in a barren desert. In fact, it becomes apparent he was visualizing himself in a desert. "My soul leads me," I quote, "my soul leads me into the desert, into the desert of my own self. I did not think that my soul is a desert, a barren, hot, dusty, without drink. The journey leads me through hot sand, slowly wading without a visible goal for hope. How eerie is this wasteland? It seems to me that the way leads so far away from mankind. I take my way step by step, and I do not know how long my journey will last. Why is myself a desert? Have I lived too much of myself in men and events? Did I avoid myself?" These are the words he transcribed on 28 November. This is, 16 days after he first addressed his soul. He's trying to make some contact. He's looking inward. He's actually visualizing a journey. And night after night after night, what's he meeting? An empty, barren wasteland. Voices occasionally would come, indicating some activity. But for 25 nights, he had to endure that quest. He had to meet the barrenness of that wilderness of his soul. Okay. In 1925, Jung gave a seminar to a small group of individuals in Zurich. This was, I'll tell you what, 11 years after the events recorded in Liber Novus, after 11 years after this last journal entry. The group wanted to know more about the formation of his psychological views, but in particularly, they wanted to know the specifics about what had happened to him during this period of his journey with Liber Novus. In Zurich in 1925, there were people who had known Jung during these years. They knew something had been going on, and they'd seen a radical transformation in his viewpoint, in his developing psychology. They wanted the details. I think the group was maybe 15 people, and they all knew Jung pretty good. And he sat down, and he gave them a seminar. Notes were taken in the seminar, and for years those notes were a private possession passed from hand to hand around the students of the C.G. Jung Institute. They weren't published until 1990 or so, the book was published of the notes. Jung complied with this request, and he gave his most explicit, yet highly abbreviated, account of the experiences recorded in Liber Novus. During his 25 nights in the desert, the period between mid-November and December of 1913, Jung was struggling to go deeper into what he now conceived as the depths. To aid the progress, he began to work intentionally with visualizations, invoking visions. Let me read you his comments from 1925 when he spoke to this group. "Not knowing what would come next, I thought perhaps more introspection was needed. When we introspect, we look within and see if there is anything to be observed. And if there is nothing, we may either give up the introspection, the introspective process, or find a way of boring through to the material that escapes our first survey. I devised such a boring method by fantasizing that I was digging a hole. And by accepting this fantasy as perfectly real. This is naturally somewhat difficult to do, To believe so thoroughly in a fantasy that it leads you further into fantasy. Just as if you were digging a real hole and passing from one discovery to another. But when I began on that hole, I worked and worked so hard that I knew something had to come of it. That fantasy had to produce more fantasy. End quote. Look, in Mary's Dreams Reflections, he tells a story. He says, I was sitting at my desk and all of a sudden the floor dropped out and I dropped. That is how he describes this vision that we're talking about here that happened on, oh, I think it was 12 December. But here in the seminar, he tells you something else. He tells you that he was actually using a technique. And what was it? You might think of it as the beginning of a guided meditation, except there was no guide. The man sat there and began to fantasize about digging. 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 Putting his concentration into the hole, into that shovel of dirt, into the fact he was trying to reach something, trying to go down. You know, this sounds easy, or maybe not, I don't know. Sounds crazy for sure. But go home and try it sometime. Digging. Digging. Did I turn the dishwasher on? Digging. Shit, I forgot the credit card bill. Digging. Digging. Why was she so pissed at me? Digging. Isn't that what happens to our consciousness, you see? We try to channel our thoughts in one direction, and it's like, oh this, oh that, oh this. We never really focus, do we? We don't clear consciousness of the spirit of this times and the due date of that American Express bill. Well, that's exactly what Jung was not doing. He was focusing. 25 nights he'd been focusing. He had to go deeper. So he continues. Finally, digging, digging. Finally, I felt I had come to a place where I could go no further down. I said to myself that, that being the case, I would go horizontally. And then it seemed as if I were in a corridor, and as though I were wading in black slime. I went in thinking to myself that this was the remnant of an old mine. A full account of what follows appears in Liber Novus. He gives an abbreviated account in Memory Streams Reflections. He gave an account in his 25 seminar as well. Let me read you the account of what happened, what he writes in Liber Novus. This is how he tells it, quote, the spirit of the depths opened my eyes, and I caught a glimpse of the inner things, the world of my soul, the many formed and changing. I stand in black dirt up to my ankles in a dark cave. Shadows sweep over me. I am seized by fear. But I know I must go in. I crawl through a narrow crack in the rock and reach an inner cave whose bottom is covered with black water. But beyond this, I catch a glimpse of a luminous red stone, which I must reach. I wade through the muddy water. The cave is full of frightful noise of shrieking voices. And they keep me away. But I want to know. Here something wants to be uttered. I place my ear to the opening. I hear the flow of underground waters. I see the bloody head of a man on the dark stream. Someone wounded, someone slain floats by there. I take in this image for a long time, shuddering. I see a large black scarab floating past on the dark stream. In the deepest reach of the stream shines a red sun, radiating through the dark water. There I see, and terror seizes me, small serpents on the dark rock walls striving towards the depth where the sun shines. A thousand serpents crowd around, veiling the sun. Deep night falls. A red stream of blood, thick red blood, springs up, surging for a long time, then ebbing. I am seized with fear. What did I see? End quote. In his 1925 seminar, 11 years later, as he's trying to explain this, Jung concludes his more abbreviated summary to the seminar group by saying this about his first evoked vision. Quote, "When I came out of the fantasy, I realized that my mechanism had worked wonderfully well. But I was in great confusion as to the meaning of all those things I had seen." I was in great confusion. He had no conceptual framework. He had no map for what he would encounter on his exploration. Jung was entering an unknown or forgotten dimension of reality. A place as close as the beating heart in his breast, and yet as distant as the faintest stars of heaven. Everything he had held as a theoretical concept would be discarded before the reality of this experience. Dr. Shyamdasani explains in his introduction to the Red Book, quote, "His procedure was clearly intentional. While its aim was to allow psychic contents to appear spontaneously," end quote. "And now, as Jung said, the spirit of the depths opened my eyes, and I caught a glimpse of inner things, the world of my soul." Jung had crossed the threshold of vision, and his sight had opened to an inner vision. A year later, he added this comment in the commentary layer of the Red Book, which you will encounter. I quote, "Because I was caught up in the spirit of this time, precisely what happened to me on this night had to happen to me. Namely, that the spirit of the depths erupted with force and swept away the spirit of this time with a powerful wave. But the spirit of the depths had gained this power because I had spoken to my soul during 25 nights in the desert, and I had given her all my love and submission. But during 25 days, I gave all my love and submission to things, to men, to the thoughts of this time. I went into the desert only at night." Thus you can differentiate sick and divine delusion. Whoever does the one and does without the other, you may call sick, since he's out of balance. Okay, so at this point, inevitably the question comes up, is this man mad? Is Jung insane? Psychotic? I was just reading a book written in 1993. I'll mention this book later if we ever get there. Yes. Where the author said that this thing that happened to Jung was clearly not voluntary, that he was overcome with a psychotic episode. Huh. That's not what happened. He was willfully approaching this material, not to say that it wasn't at the threshold, not to say that it wasn't challenging him. But you have to understand that during this period, and during the several years of this experience that continued, Jung continued to function in his daytime activities without any evident impairment to the observation of those around him. He continued to see, on average, 5 patients a day. And Dr. Shamdasani went through his appointment books and documented this fact. He had extended periods of military service. Everyone was in the Swiss Army, and World War I had started. He was on active duty for extended periods every year, functioning, apparently, just fine. He continued in his professional activities. He continued to lecture, to teach. His family life was, to say the least, complicated, but it continued. Okay. And so he said, in the balance between his night and day, he found sanity. Whoever does the one without the other, you may call sick, for he is out of balance. So this is our conundrum, all right? In modern conception, an individual who claims to have visions is either insane or using the wrong word. Finding the right word, faced against the spirit of the times, was a chore for you. In the remarks above, Jung employed the word fantasy to describe his night work. Alternative terms he used to circle the experience are imagination, vision. Unfortunately, they all suffer the same limitation. Common parlance either pathologizes or trivializes these words. Jung fractures this conundrum with his experience, with his own paradox. In subsequent years, we follow him in his writings, struggling to revalorize the barren conceptual vessel of word with a living and experienced fact. This endeavor was crucial to his extended hermeneutic project. I think it's time for cocktails and cigars. Shall we take a break?